4, 4, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Would you say 9?
Just hold on a second.
We now return to our recording already in progress.
What did you say?
Can you say deja vu?
We now return to our recording already in progress.
What did you say?
Can you say deja vu?
We now return to our recording already in progress.
What did you say?
Can you say deja vu?
Good evening, Vice President Nixon.
Good evening, Mr. Howe.
Welches sind die Regenbogenfarben?
If you do not push a key in 3 seconds, you will be disconnected.
Mein Bruder ist jünger als ich.
If not, you may either enter your extension or your name. To enter an extension. To enter your name, dial your last name followed by first name until recognized. If you are entering a name, push stop or star. When you have finished dialing an extension, push enter or pound. If you do not push a key in 5 seconds, you will be disconnected.
Actually, we're already disconnected. I don't know why that phone is ringing so loudly, but that's just the way it is. It's 7 minutes after 10 o'clock, and very good evening to one and all. This is Brain Damage, and we are here on WUSB in Stony Brook.
I will not agree to another debate.
Oh, yeah.
The answer is no. I am not going to have any more debates. We don't need any more debates. I've spelled out my position. There will be no more debates.
I've heard that a million times, but, you know, it's always good to hear it again. Just to kind of reaffirm positions and things like that. Well, we're going to be talking about the end of the war. We'll be talking about current condition around here, the future, the present. I will be taking phone calls, of course. among other things. But Jim Weiner is around somewhere. We want to talk to him before he leaves for another 3 weeks. And hopefully he'll be running in here any second to talk to us. I have absolutely nothing to say because Jim Weiner is supposed to be here and he's away somewhere. Okay, Jim, hold on. Let's find him. He's got to be around the studio somewhere. Let's see, is he in the newsroom? Oh, Jim, are you in there? Oh, Jim isn't here now. Okay, we found him. Hey, Jim, I ran out of things to say. I'm sorry, I don't usually do that.
I'm sorry, just there are a bunch of things happening. I have to take...
Running around like a crazy man.
Well, no, I am a crazy man, not like a crazy man. I am a crazy man.
Well, you're certainly running around like yourself, then.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
What's happening? Are you okay?
It's just kind of hectic. Just been kind of a hectic decade, so...
See what I have over here? Isn't this nice?
Yeah, that's a lovely, looks like Easter Bunny candy.
Yeah, it sure is. I just went to the store and found
wonderful.
This. I almost bought a bigger one. It would have cost something like $8. You know, I don't think $8 is a bit much for a piece of chocolate.
Well, I guess it depends upon how much chocolate there is.
I don't think it's a debatable point, Jim. I think it's way too much for chocolate.
If there's a quantity amount to something justifying an $8 price,
it's hollow too. For God's sake, you know it's
it could be a tremendous amount that has a hollow center, but it could still be a tremendous amount.
How do you open this anyway? It seems to be sealed in some sort of a laminated kind of a thing.
I guess that's for safety's sake.
That's what it sounds like. But, yes, Easter is around the corner. Today was the first day of spring, I think, wasn't it?
No.
Well, it sure felt like it outside.
Yes,
I was in New York City walking around, and it was everybody was out today.
Sure, but I don't think it's...
Do you know there's a plant section in New York? I discovered this today. There's a plant section, a section where every store sells plants and flowers.
Yes, it was. It along 6th Avenue?
It's around 6th Avenue.
In the 20s?
Upper 20s.
Yeah.
Upper 20s, lower 30s.
Yeah.
I never knew about it. I knew it was a garment district. I never knew it was a flower district.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
What other districts are there I don't know about? Is there perhaps a vegetable district?
There's apparently an overpriced candy district, according to you also.
Well, I got this out here. As far as I know, it's a piece of rock with wrapping around it, because I can't get the wrapping open. I'll never find out.
I didn't know that the Easter Bunny had a universal price code underneath.
Everything has a UPC code. Even the New York Times has a UPC code.
Yes.
I've never seen them actually run the New York Times over the UPC code.
No, that's true.
You know? Over the UPC scanner or whatever.
Right, right.
You know what really is something, though? Because in this very same store, which I won't mention, although they do have a red, white, and blue logo. I will say that much. But that could be anything. They are very big on UPC symbols, and henceforth, they do not display the price to human beings very often. So, very often, you're buying something, and you're walking up to the front of the store, and you have no idea how much it costs, because there's no sign anywhere, and they don't put a sticker on there, because the UPC symbol takes care of that. So, you have to go up there, and sort of a surprise when you get to the cash register, when they pass it over the thing, and it goes beepity-beep, and you say $65 for a, 10-pound bag of dog food or something.
Yeah.
And you say, no, I don't want that, and you got to unbeep it and put it back.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
Of course, you don't put it back. You put it by the cash register,
right.
And some other poor slob puts it back. You know, I don't like that. If I worked in a store, I'd be pretty upset about that. You know, people like, I saw somebody leave shampoo, right, by the cash register, you know? You don't put shampoo by the cash register. Like, the most obnoxious thing you could possibly think of doing.
Yeah, I mean, you don't take a cash register into the shower.
No, exactly,
Shouldn't leave shampoo by the
shampoo, and somebody has to come and pick that up, figure out where it goes, walk all the way back there with it, probably one by one, because I don't think they have a cart for that kind of thing. And it's, I imagine the man hours that could be saved.
Yeah.
The man hours that could be saved if everybody would just put back what they took.
That's right.
And that doesn't just go to supermarkets. That goes to everything. Living in your home, in your school, your place of work. Which reminds me, I saw a great band today. I kind of hesitate to call them a band. One person was banging on a garbage can, and the other person was strumming a guitar, and the other person was sort of careening around. I wouldn't even say a stage, because it was just like a floor, singing and occasionally singing into the microphone. And one thing they were singing about was in the workplace, how everybody should take things from the workplace. Take pencils, take erasers, paper, office supplies, computers. You know, because it's your duty as a worker to steal from your oppressors.
Oh, gee.
And, yeah, and take these things home and use them. And he, the band's called King Missile, by the way. And we have some records of theirs. And he topped it off by saying, and I'm writing this on company time. They're paying me to write about taking things from them. I thought that was just so incredible. But I don't know what album that's on, if we even have that album. But I do recommend seeing
them. Maybe one of the people that work here took the album home with them.
Oh, you wouldn't do that. We have no.
Maybe they're removing it from the workplace.
Yeah, except it's not a workplace here. This is not a workplace. This is a place of. I don't know what it is, but it's not a workplace in the traditional sense. Yeah, so we're coming up to our annual fundraiser.
Yes, we are.
And you're vital part of that.
Well,
of that process.
Nice of you to say, although I see that it took a lot of effort for you to.
Well, I couldn't say the right word, so I said a different word. Yeah, but
you know, kind of you to, but obviously your view of it is deep down inside, you feel differently because you couldn't quite say it. And
no, I couldn't, but...
And it's true, Eric. I think that this year I'll help the radio station in the radiothon by not showing up. I think it should improve our chances immeasurably.
Well, I think the listeners would agree with that. Yeah, and sometimes when you have nothing to say, you should say something bad. Isn't that how it goes?
Yeah, that's it. If you don't have anything nice to say about anybody, if you don't have anything nice to say about anybody, say as many bad things as you can about them.
Right. Say nothing if you have. Okay, I got it. I understand.
If you have something good to say about somebody, say nothing. Yeah, that's it.
What's in gefilte fish?
Oh,
I had that today.
I don't.
When somebody asked me what was in it, and I really couldn't answer.
I think it's like a white fish with...
It's really cold, I can tell you.
Yeah, it is. It is. I really kind of forgot exactly how it's
That's
prepared.
Sort of how I got out of it, too.
Yeah.
But it didn't really
I
work.
I think maybe the word gefilte means I really don't know how this is prepared.
Hey, look at this. I opened up the chocolate rabbit. I'm starting to.
Congratulations.
I don't know how I did it, and getting a little bits and pieces of it off here.
Actually, you know, I think somebody's waiting for me to take a message, so I really... While you're unwrapping it, I think I'll run back to the phone.
Okay, well, Jim, I'm going to... since I'm in kind of a strange mood, I'm going to play some Clash songs. Which
great.
When I'm in a strange mood.
Okay.
Because we're talking about the end of this war and everything like that, and I don't know what I'm going to get into later, but I'll probably be kind of depressed and angry and not easy to get along with. And the best way for me to live with myself is to play a bunch of Clash songs.
Okay, sounds reasonable.
So perhaps while I cue something up, you can just sort of... say something intelligent.
Well, let's...
intelligent while I'm chewing up a record.
Let me see if I can go with you halfway. Let me just say something.
Good enough.
Yes, indeed.
Great start, Jimmy. I mean, you're
thank
a
you.
Radio natural.
Thank you. I know. You know, what I think is that... actually, you mentioned districts in the city. Do you know that there is a district in the city... known as the district. It is a district where different people have different emporiums or emporia devoted to the paraphernalia of the various districts of the city.
Now, you've reached the halftime point of that story, and for the halftime show, I'm going to tell people that the... this is really disgusting. The inside of this bunny... looks absolutely nothing like the bunny on the outside. There's no face, just like a mass of brown, lumpish type stuff. And it's sort of melting in my hands even as I speak. And I'm not, I think it's hollow. Yep, they're hollow and fine. Okay.
Most are, which I kind of like, actually.
Blow into this. See, that's what the inside of the chocolate bunny sounds like. Now, Jim, let's finish up that story in an exciting second half.
No, that was it.
That was it.
District. Yeah.
Okay, Jim. Well, you have your duties to take care of, and I have mine. And right now we're going to play some Clash songs. If you have any... don't call for the Clash, because I just want to play what I want to hear. I know it sounds selfish. I don't usually do that. I usually listen to what people have to say, but I just got to get out of my system, you know, and then I'll be in a better frame of mind. Bear with me. That's all I ask, and... give us a call in a little while, 632-6901. We'll be taking phone calls, and you can tell us what you feel now that we've plummeted back into peace, so to say. 632-6901, as we celebrate Easter, spring, and, well, something else. See you in 3 weeks, Jim.
Yeah.
Nothing else you want to say?
No.
Okay. This kind of music should never be talked over, I think. Except in special occasions, you know, like a party.
Five-inch thongs in Andalusia. The shooting tide in the days of 39. Old trees leave the vendetta open. The ritual altars dead and gone. Bullet holes in the cemetery walls. The flag cars, the guardian of the beer. Five-inch thongs on the Costa Rica. I'm dying here on the TV set tonight.
long. Long and long.
Volatile, volatile test. that song. The immigrants, they wanna sing all night long. It could be anywhere, or it might be, could be any frontier, any hemisphere. No man's land.
Recycling is one of the simplest ways each of us can contribute to a healthier environment.
This is a public service announcement.
I feel better now. I don't know. You know, those times when you just have to play a lot of music and get yourself kind of unwound. Well, I'm unwound now. A little bit unwound, anyway. And we heard various bits and pieces from The Clash. Some of my favorite songs off albums such as London Calling, Give Them Enough Rope, Combat Rock. and many others, of course, we can't get to because we'll be here all night just playing music, and this is actually a talk show, so we should talk a bit anyway. Our number is 632-6901, and I guess technically this is now peacetime again. What do you think? Peacetime is with us, and I'm certainly glad about that. It's a couple of days last week, or this week just passed by, where it didn't really matter what happened. The fact of the matter was it was over, or at least it seemed to be over. You know, both sides saying they want to cease fire. They want to bring the madness to an end. And there comes a point where you just don't care about who is right and who is wrong and how certain things happened and how certain things should have happened. It doesn't matter. The fact is it's over. And if it's over, well, that's good enough for you, you know? Well, a couple of days have passed now, and for a couple of days, I have people yelling my name outside. Oh, I see. I get it now. Hi, Dave. That song went out to you. Okay. People sending me all kinds of weird messages here. After a couple of days, you just start thinking, you know, what really happened just now? What was that war that just went by? And what were the effects of it? What are the long-lasting effects? And what actually happened, you know? We know that under 100 U.S. Military people were killed, which I guess is good, considering how many could have been killed, but of course it's bad, considering that that's 100 more than should have died, I guess. But it's incredibly, incredibly light casualty figures, considering what we were told, what everybody said was going to happen if we got involved in a war with Iraq. Well, we got involved with a war, in a war with Iraq. We got involved with a land war, air war. I don't think we had much of a sea war. But all of that happened, and the casualties were incredibly white. And that is good. That part of it is good. That everybody will be coming back home, and I, for one, am very happy to be seeing that. But there are flip sides. There are flip sides to everything, and there are consequences, and there are questions. Things that just won't go away. Our number is 632-6901, area code 516. We're going to get into a bit more specifics. First, though, I want Billy Bragg to say something. In that inimitable style of his. My youngest son came home today. His friends marched with him all the way.
Upon the narrow Belfast street, as children's flooding gutters fill in dreams of glory unfulfilled. As part of freedom's price to pay, my youngest son came home today. My youngest son came home today. His friends marched with him all the way. The pipe and drum beat out the time, while in his box of polished pine, like dead meat on a butcher's tray. Son came home today. And this time he's here to stay.
You see, when it comes down to the end, that's what it is. Dead meat on a butcher's tray. It's this crap about being a hero and giving your life for your country. Well, you, in most cases, you don't give your life. Your life is taken. And all of this bravado is propaganda, is what it is. Let me read you an article and then get into a bit more details. Comes from yesterday's Newsday article by Paul Vitello. He's the guy that writes articles, and for some reason prints his picture next to them. I don't know why. And he's not a bad-looking guy, but, you know, not everybody prints their pictures. It was a column, but still, I don't know why the picture is necessary. Yesterday came the first estimate from the front about what it means to kick butt. The U.S. General H. Norman Schwarz... Okay, I can say it. I have said it before, and I will say it again. Schwarzkopf, there, was on the radio saying there were a very large number of Iraqis dead. A man was tying his cross-country skis to the rack of his car. He had his radio on and his car door open, and the general's voice was booming over the snow-covered ground at Caleb Smith State Park Preserve. This is on Thursday afternoon when these words came out. Very large number, the general said. The sky was beautifully blue in Smithtown. The general didn't say how many was a very large number. He probably did not know. I try not to pay attention to the war, said the man tying his skis with the radio blaring. That's why I come here, to get away a little bit. He was on his lunch break. The number of dead on the other side may never be headline news, even if it is in the tens of thousands. And the figure I heard on, I believe it was either NBC or ABC, yesterday was 150,000. They are, after all, the other side. Many people will feel that because it was Saddam Hussein's fault, because the slaughter of Iraqi soldiers might not have happened if he had agreed to unconditional withdrawal in the first place, that there is nothing further to say. But sooner or later, when the parades are finished, we will face the reality of what happened over there. Sooner or later, even if we believe that this was a just war, it will become more and more difficult to believe that it was a fair fight. We may have been cross-country skiing at the time, or baking a cake for the children, or doing a good deed for a neighbor, but we as a nation will sooner or later remember this time as the time we killed a very large number of retreating soldiers, for fundamentally political reasons, not military ones. Schwarzkopf said this on the radio, too. He said his mission from the beginning had been to neutralize Saddam Hussein's war-making power, not simply to free Kuwait. To this end, A-6 intruders and B-52 bombers dropped 1,000-pound bombs on the retreating Iraqi divisions as they marched out in the open, out of Kuwait, toward home. We hit the jackpot, one pilot told Pool reporters. He compared the road to Basra in Iraq to the roads of Florida at Easter vacation. It was the road to Daytona Beach at spring break, just bumper to bumper, he said, describing the retreat. Spring break's over, he said. At Caleb Smith State Park Preserve yesterday, the wind blew clumps of snow from high branches of the evergreen trees. Actually, this was Thursday. And the snow floated down like confetti, catching the light from the sun. There was no particular point in being in this place on Thursday, except to be in a place where the earth has a history that predates the modern era, which is the era of industrialized war. The geese nap here. The crows sit in the highest branches of the trees, waiting for whatever they wait for. The wind makes live trees bend. It makes the dead ones crack and snap. Creak and snap, I'm sorry. Living and dead trees stand together here. There is no particular point in being here except that it is on the other side of the world from war. If war is the art of entrapment and killing, the earth is the opposite. You see it in every branch of every tree, 1,000 fingers finding 1,000 different ways to get life. You have seen the faces of the Iraqis surrendering to soldiers, surrendering to American TV crews, to Italian TV crews, surrendering to anyone who would take them alive. They were like Americans, more or less, only Iraqis, said a sergeant from Tennessee. They didn't look aggressive. They didn't look like they wanted to be out killing anything. They didn't look like they wanted to do this anymore, he said. People with geopolitical instincts will say it is naive at best to quibble over enemy dead. Karl von Clausewitz, the Prussian military strategist, wrote, "In dangerous things such as war, errors made out of kindness are the worst. Let us hear no more about generals who conquer without bloodshed." But Clausewitz is not an authority on right and wrong. Churchmen throughout the country were calling for a ceasefire. And the president declared one on Thursday, 4 days after the enemy said it was prepared to withdraw. The president has said that this war is our defining hour. We should hope it is not. We should hope our defining hour starts now. That article from Friday's Newsday from Paul Vitello. I can sort of see why now he wants to put his picture on it. And if indeed there were 150,000 people on the other side killed, 150,000 soldiers, God knows how many civilians. Is this something we can really sit back and be proud about? You know, yeah, we got Kuwait back, okay. And we were able to do it quickly. But what kind of a cost is too much of a cost? You know, what kind of human suffering are we willing to inflict to prevent human suffering? Is an Iraqi life worth less than an American life? I think a lot of people would say yes. I know a lot of people would say yes. And I just can't see how that is correct. I don't see how you can reach that conclusion. Now, I saw the headlines for today's newspapers. Words to the effect of, will our heroes get a parade down Fifth Avenue, and how much will the parade cost? And, you know, I don't want to get this wrong, because I'm probably happier than most people that they're coming home. But I don't really know if heroes is the right word to describe them. I mean, yeah, they did put their lives on the line for what they supposedly believed in, which not necessarily freeing Kuwait, but believing in the military system, because the military sends you where they say they're going to send you. They don't give you an option. They don't say, check here for Panama, check here for Kuwait, check here for Grenada. They give the orders, you follow the orders. No ifs, ands, or buts. And that's why I say, you don't give your life. Your life is taken. You sign up for the military for whatever reason. Most people don't sign up to invade a particular country. They sign up for career reasons, because it'll pay for their education, because they believe in the military, what have you. They're doing what they believe in, and I guess anybody that does that is a hero. Nobody wants to die. Nobody wants to risk their life unnecessarily. I just find it completely barbaric that we would consider having a parade down Fifth Avenue when we've killed so many people in such a short amount of time. I mean, yeah, maybe they were the wrong people. Maybe they were wrong to be over there. They invaded a country they shouldn't have been in, but they were still human beings. And we can be happy that our human beings were not massacred. But I think we owe it to the human race to be a bit somber about what has occurred. Now, I don't have the facts. And I'm kind of annoyed that I don't have the facts, because I've been asking, I've been trying to find out the facts, and nobody has a straight answer here. Nobody knows how many Iraqis were killed. How many? Nobody knows. I've heard figures as low as 10,000, which is a lot of people. 10,000 people. I mean, can you imagine if 10,000 Americans were killed? And our country is so much bigger than Iraq. So much bigger. Figures as low as 10,000, figures as high as 150,000. And God knows how many people will die of starvation, disease, exposure to the elements. And when asked, what are we going to do to get Iraq back on its feet? How many of you felt a particular sense of pride when President Bush said words to the effect of, we're not going to do a damn thing about it. Not one penny is going to go to help them. Oh, just busted my buttons. Just how in the world will they get back on their feet? Who will they turn to? Or will they just wither away and die, never to cross anybody again? These are tough, very tough questions and prospects to deal with. But I was listening to the news this evening, hearing reports of the city coming up with $150,000 to pay for a parade. And we're talking about 150,000 people killed. And aren't those people just as much heroes as our people? They fought for what they believed in. Yeah, what they believed in was wrong. And of course, the people that committed atrocities on whatever side, obviously wrong by any human standard. But look at the faces of the people that surrendered. Look at the faces of the people that that were scared for weeks, being mercilessly bombed and destroyed. Those people. I don't know. I just I find it very difficult to condone that kind of a thing. And I believe it all could have been done with different consequences. We could have achieved the same results with a different plan. Might have taken a little longer. Might have even cost a little more. Although I don't really think so. I don't see how anything could cost more than a war. But this kind of loss of life, and just so flagrantly cast away, is, well, they asked for it. What I hear is one man asked for it. From what I hear, Saddam Hussein is responsible for all of it. The one guy we can't seem to ever find, even though the day of the war, cable news network reported his exact whereabouts at the TV studio. They saw him there. There was no real attempt made to prevent him from being seen. Well, we can't stop this one person, so we have to kill nearly a quarter of a million of his underlings, and it's all his fault. I don't know. Either it's a lot more complex than that, and either the Iraqi people are evil, or we've just had the wool pulled over our eyes yet again, and had the 2-month hate that we all live through. I don't know. I don't know how we can have parades at a time like this. Yes, welcome. Welcome our brothers and sisters home. And be kind to them. And show them all the love and understanding that they are entitled to as our brothers and sisters. But celebrating something of this magnitude, I just can't see it. And I think it's bad for the future. Because what will happen? What will happen to this country in the years ahead, you know, when the next conflict comes up? There will be another conflict, you know that. And now that we know how incredibly easy it is, well, who knows what will happen when the conflict is a little bit harder, you know, like we lived through the chemical weapons threat and the biological weapons threat. Well, maybe now we're ready for the nuclear weapons threat. Who knows? Who knows what we're going to attempt next? You know, this bravado is going to prove to be a bit of a disease that's hard to shake. I'd certainly like to hear people's opinions, pro or con. Our telephone number is 632-6901. I was at a radio station convention today in New York City, and one of the panels I was on had to do with war coverage and some of the things that various non-commercial radio stations were doing, and commercial radio stations, too, for that matter. There were some commercial broadcasters there. And at least a couple of them really seemed to understand what censorship is all about and how the media is controlled by the military. And it's to be expected. The military doesn't want certain things to get out, and the media wants to get certain things out. What I found to be especially disturbing, and maybe some of our callers can help us with this, this was something that was attended by a lot of college radio stations, and what a lot of college students seemed to have difficulty with was why the press was giving the military such a hard time. You know, why they couldn't just back off a bit and let the military do its job. And this reporter from CBS News was obviously almost as perplexed as I am about this. Pretty much saying how it's the press's responsibility to not believe what they are told, to question authority. And when they do this, it should not be looked upon as something detrimental, as something disrespectful, but rather something necessary. If you didn't have a questioning press, you never would have found out about Watergate. You never would have found out about all kinds of scandals. And a good investigative reporter will dig. What we saw during the Iraq War was very little of that. Very little investigation going on, except on networks like Pacifica, for instance. Very little questioning, and a lot of just going with the propaganda. And I hate saying that word, because we really shouldn't be using a word like that here. But when you have one source of information, and everybody listens to that one source, and is slanted in a particular direction, then that is propaganda, my friends. Plain and simple propaganda. Now, if you're not convinced, think about this. You have Saddam Hussein, who believes he is right. You have George Bush, who believes he is right. It's a conflict. It's two people who disagree. How many newspapers, how many TV reports did you see that presented it in that light? I didn't see any, including Pacifica. I didn't see any because Hussein was always seen as a villain. And justifiably so. I mean, the man's words that I can't say on the radio. Definitely. No question about it. Ask Amnesty International 2 years ago. They said the same thing. And there's many more that we're giving money to now that will probably be problems later on. But it was not presented in that neutral, non-slanted way. It's impossible. You cannot do it. You cannot present things in a non-slanted way. But to expect, for some reason, the press not to question our side is wrong, because that is what the press is here for. The press is here to ask the inconvenient questions. And, you know, you don't see that. You just don't see that enough. You see it sometimes. You see the Bush press conferences, and usually the only person to ask a probing question is that crazy lady Sarah that they pull out of the hat somewhere, and she always asks these questions and is sort of laughed at. But I remember some of the Reagan press conferences of a couple of years ago, and that was an experience, because they got after him when he said certain things that did not make sense. They asked him what he was talking about. And I remember one particular time in the midst of the Iran arms sale scandal, the White House had to actually issue a statement after a press conference saying, well, what the president meant to say was this. And the arms for hostages, well, do we talk to terrorists, or don't we talk to terrorists? Well, we don't negotiate, but we do talk. What does that mean? You've got to hit these people constantly with questions. Because you and I cannot do this as citizens, and we must trust the press to do this for us, and to do this in as many different ways as possible. What I saw today, and I did not see this from everybody, of course, but a lot of college students seem to feel that it's wrong to question authority. It's wrong to question the government. We should believe what they say. And I think there's nothing more unhealthy in a democracy than to not ask questions. One person in particular said, you know, I've seen so much of this war on TV, we don't need to see so much of it. We don't need to see the war all the time. We don't need to see body bags and wounded bodies and all this information about weaponry. We don't need this. People don't want to hear it. Now think about it. If you don't tell people what is going on, and case in point, 150,000 Iraqis killed. You don't hear that on the news. Should be a top story, I think, for quite a while. But you don't hear it, and when you don't hear it, it doesn't affect you. When you don't find out, you know, one of the things at the Washington, D.C. January 26th rally, one thing that will always stick with me is the wife of a man who served in Vietnam who didn't make it back, describing what it was like when his remains did come back, describing hundreds of bullet holes and horrible things that made you realize that it's so much more than just a box wrapped in a flag. It was more than a man who gave his life to his country. It was horror. It was blood. It was pain. And we have the obligation to show that. And to make it clear that that is what is going on. And if we don't do that, then we're numbing ourselves to it. We're avoiding it. And we're paving the way for it in the future. And God help us as far as what lies in store for us if we continue to do this. The war is over. But we need to get the facts about what happened, what was known, what could have been done. And I know people will say I'm being judgmental and tearing the policies of the government apart. Yeah, I always do that. I always do that. I always question everything. I think it's something that has to be done. Think of what happens if nobody does it. If we all just fall into step. Even if this was completely justifiable, and I do not believe it is, but even if it does prove to be completely justifiable, if we fall into this routine the next time or five times in the future, how much easier will it be to completely pull the wool over our eyes? You tell me. 632-6901. Good evening. Hello, is anybody there?
Oh, hi. I just wanted you to know that I know what's in gefilte fish.
Well, now's not the time to tell me.
No?
All right. Tell me quickly.
I do have an opinion on George Bush, though.
Okay.
I just wanted, when George Bush was saying he didn't want to see 1 cent of American money going towards the rebuilding of Iraq, he did qualify, not to say that George Bush is such a great guy, but he did say that if it were to save a child or to do something humanitarian, then he would perhaps give money just like he said the America or the United States has always done. So he was sort of...
Do you remember the exact quote?
No, I don't remember the exact quote, but it was something he said about a night or two ago.
Uh-huh.
And that he sort of was trying to appeal to both sides of the...
Well, you see, I was hoping he was meaning, you know, just military. And obviously I couldn't see him putting any money in now, even though he did in the past, to build up the military. But I did not see any qualification there saying, yeah, I'll pay for humanitarian things.
He definitely said that. And he said, as the United States would always do.
Uh-huh.
And he was there appealing to both sides of the both opinions that Americans might have, and therefore being a politician like he is to appeal to everyone. And not to say he's such a great guy, it's just that you know, he has to do that in order to gain our love and respect.
What do you think of victory parades?
Victory parades? Well, do what you want. I don't know.
Well, what do you want?
What do I want? Okay, I don't know. What was it, $150,000 for a victory parade?
Well, it's not so much the cost. It's just...
Should we celebrate?
Is there something, besides having people come home, which of course we should celebrate, then I think that's sort of like a private thing with families and friends and things like that, but I don't know. There's just something about ticker tape parades for, you know, this kind of a thing. It rubs me the wrong way, you know? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I guess it depends on how you look at it and how it's being celebrated and what the people are celebrating are thinking. I mean, are they thinking, you know, this is great that we've killed all these people, or is it great that they're all coming home, or that
It's nice that Kuwait is not in Iraqi hands. I agree to that.
Mm-hmm.
And if that was all it was, hey, a ticker tape parade would not be a bad idea, but it's just, you think of all the things that have happened. I mean, think of if we had lost 10,000 lives too, and it had ended just as quickly, we wouldn't be feeling in such a celebratory mood, would we?
Well, no, because that's the way we are. I mean, we won a war,
basically,
and we want to celebrate. I guess it's what the people want. I mean, we want to feel good about something. People need to feel good about something. And anything that will help that along. I mean, we all want to feel good about something. We all want to gather together and just feel good together. It's just a natural human desire to get together with people and cheer for a cause. I mean, that's a lot of what the people gathering together, anti-war, everything.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of it has to do with people wanting to gather together like that, and it makes them feel good to know that they share ideas with other people, and that it goes along with the whole just wanting to be like everyone else, and to know that you're in agreement with other people.
How do you think, one final question, the anti-war movement will be judged in light of how this all turned out?
I'm sorry, what, one more time?
How do you think the anti-war movement is going to be judged in light of how this all concluded?
Well, judged by whom?
Well, by the American people in general, I suppose.
Well, I guess the anti-war people will view them well, and the pro-war people will view them as they've always viewed them, I think. I mean, I don't know. I mean, what's your question, really?
I'm just wondering if they'll be looked upon as trying to hinder what actually took place. I mean, the United States has gone in and succeeded quite well at what it was they intended to do. I guess what I'm asking is, would the anti-war activists be seen as trying to prevent them from doing that, or as having a noble cause but a misguided cause, or as eventually being proven right in the future as to trying to prevent the tragedy?
Well, in the future we might find out things that we don't know now, therefore they might be viewed as being right all along, but I don't know. I mean, how do we view past anti-war? I mean, I guess we view the Vietnam people.
Well, that's what bothers me. You see, the Vietnam demonstrators
are viewed as great as heroes.
No,
the
they're
heroes
not.
Of the war. We stopped the war.
They're not viewed as that at all. I found that out this the past couple of months. For some reason, the anti-war movement is blamed for the way the Vietnam veterans have been treated. And nobody seems to think of the fact that, well, these people were involved in a war that was completely unjustified, and they were ignored by the same government that sent them over there. And, you know, while there were some anti-Vietnam demonstrators that treated the vets with disrespect, I don't think that was the case for all of them, and I certainly don't think they deserve the blame for the way the Vietnam thing turned out.
I was unaware of that happening.
Yeah, well, that's the kind of thing that you meet up with when you march in the streets. You
really
see all the hostility and...
Yes, I mean, but those are the pro-war people. I mean, from the anti-war people from the 60s, you'd ask them now, and they'd view the... or anti-war people now, you know, college students now will view the Vietnam anti-war people as being the heroes, as being people who stopped the war. I mean, I think it all depends who you talk to.
Uh-huh.
And
I guess it is what it depends upon.
Yeah.
And we all have different perspectives on this.
Yeah, I mean, but when, like, you know, 100 years from now, if everyone's still around, you know, we might look up in a history book, who knows what it might say about this war and about the anti-war demonstrators. And they're probably, I don't know, I really have no idea. Who knows how huge an event this will be seen in a history book?
Uh-huh.
And this was how long did it didn't last? It didn't last as long as everyone expected it to. I mean, providing it just doesn't start up again, which it probably won't. I don't know. I mean, who knows how history might view it, and whether the anti-war demonstrators will be a big part of the story. I mean, in Vietnam they were the anti-war sentiment became a subculture. You know, as everyone knows, and I don't really think that happened. So I don't know if it's going to be such a huge issue, at least in the history books. I mean, it seems like there was anti-war sentiment, and there was a lot of pro-war sentiment. It was, you know, fairly even, I guess. It wasn't anything huge or revolutionary, really.
Okay, thanks so much for calling.
Also,
yeah,
if you're going to eat gefilte fish, don't eat it with anything tart like cranberries.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
I'll try to remember that.
Okay.
Thanks for calling.
All right, you're welcome.
An appeal to whoever is picking up the phones in the studio, please stop doing that. Someone is picking up the phones, and perhaps somebody else could call in, and if someone else other than me picks up, tell them I asked them not to do that. because one of the features here at Brain Damage is that we allow our callers to call in and not have to pay while they're on hold. Now there's a whole bunch of people on hold, and they should not be on hold. So stop picking up the phone. Oh, don't you hate it when people try to help and you don't want them to? 632-6901, area code 516. Good evening. Well, I didn't say hang up to the people that are on hold. Good evening.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay, how are you?
I got a lot of little miscellaneous things.
Yeah, go ahead. You're on a cordless phone, aren't you?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Okay, well, try not to move around.
Okay. One thing, you know this New World Order catchphrase. Do you know where that comes from?
It comes from Hitler, doesn't it?
It's on the back of a dollar bill.
Back of a dollar bill?
Yeah, if you have a dollar bill on you.
Oh, hold on. Let me see if I can find it. I thought it had something to do with Nazis.
No, actually, it's on the back of the dollar bill with the pyramid with the eye. It says, Novus Ordo Seclorum.
It does say, Novus Ordo...
I heard that on, I think, the Pacific Report or something like that.
Seclorum.
On another show or something.
You know, there's also a year here. What year is this on the pyramid? It's MDCCLXXVI. Now, let me try to figure that one out. That's,
I would say that's 1776.
1776. Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Didn't think about it that way.
Another interesting thing. Do you know Bob Simon, the guy who was captured?
I heard he was released as of this morning.
It's interesting that when he was in Beijing reporting on the student uprising, he was the one who was captured by the Chinese and held for a day or two.
I remember that.
Right.
He's got quite a resume.
So I don't know if this guy has a habit of getting captured or something. It's a kind of unusual coincidence.
Well, I expected him to turn up again because it was my personal feeling that if an American had been killed, everybody would have known about it.
Yeah.
Everybody there would have, because, and that's sort of, you know, it's sort of is troubling that that American lives are viewed as so much more than Arab lives. That bothers me so much.
Well, I think that's in part the Arabs themselves probably would not look upon lives of the other Arabs as worth as much, maybe of their family. Here, I think the best example would be the way you treat strangers on the street and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well,
there's two different...
in the United States. I'm not really sure. I really don't know much about the Arabs. Which brings me to another thing, is that if you really want to find out what happened, you'll probably have to wait for the historians to get around to digging into the whole battle and everything, because the press is really terrible at reporting. They don't, the people that they sent over there, first of all, they sent about 1,000 or so people into Saudi Arabia. I don't even know what the numbers were.
Well, I hear there were more cameras than tanks. So.
Yeah, but those people, for example, I can give you an example of Kafji, the Battle of Kafji, and they said, it shows a remarkable use of the, by the Iraqis, of night maneuvers or something like that. And it's, you know, everybody got worried that the Iraqis can maneuver at night, and all these people getting very worried. And if you looked at the calendar, it was a full moon. So, of course, you can conduct night maneuvers under a full moon.
Uh-huh.
It's when there's no moon that it would be a difficult thing. But nobody in the press picked this up. I mean, they're basically brain dead. I mean, Dan Rather and that whole crew, I mean, they're pretty faces to look at. And you read the two-page briefing, and that's enough. Another thing is the Italian pilot who was shot down. How was he shot down? That's an interesting thing to know. Was he flying missions over Iraq or over Kuwait? That's pretty interesting that the Italians being right up there in front. But they didn't pursue it.
I don't know that story. Tell me that story.
Well, an Italian pilot was shot down, and he was one of the people who ended up getting the, you know, with the puffy face and everything being on TV.
Okay.
He was a POW or EPW, whatever you want to, alphabet soup. But it never came out how this guy was shot down or the situation which led to his capture.
Uh-huh.
Was he in a bombing mission? Was he flying support? What was he doing? I mean, it's pretty interesting to want to know who was in at the beginning, who, you know, committed their forces in terms of that. But the press never pursued that. They're all looking, you know, the people in the press have deluded themselves into thinking they're smart, and they're really not. These people are, I mean, one week they're in reporting on the war in Saudi Arabia, and next week they're off talking about the coup in Thailand. These people, they really don't know what the hell they're doing. I mean, so,
well, You know, it's easy to say that.
They're easy. That's why they're so easy to manipulate, because they really don't know. I mean, if you took somebody like Tony Cordesman, Dr. Doom from ABC, and put him over there in a press briefing, he would be the one to ask the right questions of Schwarzkopf. But he wasn't. Why wasn't he there?
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's the person you want, somebody who's in the field and knows it. Because he'll ask the questions of Schwarzkopf that'll put Schwarzkopf in a corner. But no, you have these other people who have no idea what the hell's going on.
Well, you see, I think the problem is that too many press people are looking with one uneasy eye at the American public. They don't want to be seen as being disrespectful or anti-American or anything like that. And that hinders your ability to be a good journalist, because if you're constantly thinking about how your questions are going to be interpreted by your readers or your viewers, you're never going to be able to ask the questions that you really want to ask, because, you know, it's kind of like a trial in a way. You have to ask these questions in order to get to the root of the matter.
Yeah, but it's even a simple question that the press itself feeds off of itself, and I've seen that. I've been at a number of...
Yeah, it's laziness. It's laziness, and...
That's why they're so easy to manipulate. I mean, you can very, very easily manipulate the press, because they just... The people that report don't know what the hell they're doing. They have no concept of the thing that they're reporting on.
If you can get it into the Associated Press, you've got it in every newspaper in the country, because everybody reads the Associated Press. Now, there should be,
Associated Press and UPI and Reuters usually are a lot better than the regular, normal ABC, NBC, you know, your television networks, your press reporters.
Yeah, but sir, where do you think ABC gets their news from? They read AP, too. AP
goes
everywhere.
Some of them, but then they send somebody there. They're better, but they're still not all there.
Right, but it's a major part of it. I mean, many, many, many times I have listened to a commercial radio station like WCBS, which does all news, listen to a story, and then turn to this radio station here, WUSB, and heard the exact same story word for word. Now, that tells me that neither one of the stations is doing any work as far as getting the story. And that's something not serving anybody. It's propaganda. It's one news source.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. But, it brings us all the way back to, you know, you're talking about all these people being killed. I hadn't even thought about that, you know, until I listened to your program, and it made me realize, you know, that the horror of what had happened. And I think you're right about this parade. I think there should be a day of prayer or a day of peace or something like that, rather than a parade down Fifth Avenue, where people would stop and take a day off and reflect on what had happened. And let's hope that it never has to happen again.
And, you know, I somehow think that the people that were there would understand that a lot more than the people who weren't.
Right.
The people that were there were really itching.
I mean, to get in. You talk about propaganda. Well, these people in the military get propaganda too, and I mean they're really jacked up to before they go in. One of the things I've been doing. I said I've been unemployed, so I've been reading every newspaper and watching every TV account. It's interesting. I don't know if you saw this little report that the fighter pilots in the first days of the war, they were pumping them up with amphetamines.
Uh-huh.
And they were giving them downers to allow them to sleep at night. And they did that for about the first 3 or 4 days to keep them going.
I mean, you know, no disrespect intended, but for all intents and purposes, these people were killing machines. They did nothing but fly, you know, day and night killing.
Exactly.
Left and right. Now, I'm not in any way saying that they are, you know, by... following the orders, they were wrong, and they're murderers and things like that. I mean, you know, it's a tough one to call, but celebrating is something that I just don't think is appropriate at all.
Yeah, well, I think it's the feeling of relief.
Yeah, the feeling of relief, I understand completely.
I think that the TV coverage of the war contributed to a great stress among the country. If it was a newspaper, you read it, and it's a little more distance to it than if you're watching it on TV and you see the pictures coming back, the bombing of Baghdad and the Scud missiles. I mean, when those first Scuds hit Israel, I don't know about you, but I was getting ready to dig a hole in the ground and bury myself because I thought World War III was coming at that point.
It was a very scary day. I was in a newsroom, in fact, for that night, and it was very intense. A lot of people were getting very emotional about the whole thing.
And you're watching it on TV, and you're sharing in it.
But think of this, sir. Think of Baghdad. You know, think of what it was like there, night after night after day of constant bombing. And here you have these occasional Scud missiles. You know, every so often they hit something. But, you know, the relentless bombing, which supposedly made the whole thing a success. But think of the horror of living through that.
Exactly.
Think of the scars that will last a very long time. So I want to thank you very much for calling and keep hearing from you in the future.
Yeah.
Okay. And hopefully someday they'll make cordless phones sound better than that. 632-6901, Erica 516. Good evening.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to you about the Iraqi point of view.
Yeah, go ahead.
What do you think about the people that coming into the stores and harassing the people just because they're from Iraq?
Is that happening?
I've seen it around my neighborhoods because some of the Iraqis own like the local 7-Elevens and stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, and it's funny because I know Indian people get harassed too. Anybody that even looks like they might be Iraqi get harassed. Are you even certain that they are Iraqi?
I'm not even sure, but people just assume that they are.
And what kind of things happen?
You know, they come into the store late at night and smash the windows. Just basic vandalism.
Well, that you know, that tells you something. I mean, it's pretty obvious that's hatred that has been generated by all of this.
I think it's just ignorance on our part.
Yeah, it certainly is. I don't think we understand what it was that we were fighting.
They left their country because of this.
Exactly.
That's why we have to harass them all the time.
I don't know. Have you had any personal contact with the people affected by this?
Not really myself, but I've known people that have.
You know people that have actually participated?
Yes. And I asked them why they didn't. They didn't. They thought that they should because we're at war with someone where they think they live.
You see, that's what's so troublesome about being at war. We're now at war, therefore we must do this. And I think when we are at war, that is when you appeal to your democratic principles more than ever. That's when you question authority. That's when you take to the streets if necessary, if you disagree with something. And that's when you act in a fair manner.
Exactly.
You know? And
you have to learn to speak our minds more with our local governments and tell them what we think.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy during peacetime to say what you think, but during wartime, that's when it becomes essential. You know, I went to D.C. for the demonstration. I was also at a couple of others. And, you know, even though this is all over, and, you know, I don't know how much of an effect the peace movement actually had, I want to say the bonding that I felt with the people that were there is something that I will never forget and something that I will always be proud of, the fact that I was there with those people at that time. Standing up for something that we believed in. And, you know, when you do something like go to a pro-war rally and hold up a peace sign and stand with other people doing the same thing, it's something that I cannot possibly put into words. It's a feeling that you know you're doing the right thing by standing up for what you believe in. And I'm not saying you have to agree with me as far as what I believe in, but standing up for what it is that you hold true to your heart. That is
I admire
what it's
you for
all
that.
About.
I think more people should start to do the same.
Yeah.
Do what they feel, not what they think.
Yeah, and don't go along with the bandwagon, no matter whose side it is.
Exactly.
All right. Thanks so much for calling, sir.
Okay.
632-6901. That's our telephone number. It's 11:31. Good evening.
Yeah, how you doing?
Hi.
Listen, what's up with these stamps tonight? I called back like 3 times. They put me on hold.
I don't know. Did we put an end to that, Cindy? Was somebody picking up the phone? Was that you?
People are trying to make calls out.
Oh, they shouldn't do that. These phones are all messed up, so if you pick it up. See, we have intelligent phones that when you pick up the phone, it knows which one you want to answer, even if you don't want to answer one. So sometimes that happens.
I just called back like three, after you said not to do that. I called back like 3 times. They put me on hold.
Well, I do apologize on behalf of them, and they will be dealt with later.
Okay. Did you see about the... There was a couple of Iraqi troops that helped dig out the... I believe it was an American jeep that was stuck in the sand and they surrendered.
I heard about that.
See, the thing I was trying to point out is that I think that's why the ground war was kind of like a joke.
Why is that?
Because so many Iraqi soldiers, like, they just surrendered because they couldn't stand Saddam Hussein.
Why do you think it was, why do you think we didn't know this, that it was going to be so easy? We were expecting it to, to reach a stage where it was going to be very bloody, but in actuality, none of the Iraqis seemed to want to go through with this. Don't you think some intelligence would have reached us somehow saying, well, this war is going to be a lot easier than we thought?
Yeah, probably, but the Iraqi people that were fighting, they just didn't want, they surrendered, they were smiling, like, please take us.
Uh-huh.
Like, we don't want to fight anymore.
And, you know, I can't help but wonder, all the people that were killed, would they have done the same thing given the opportunity? I was told the people were retreating out of Kuwait, yet because they were retreating in their armored vehicles, they were destroyed.
Well, then you have some of the people that agree with what Saddam Hussein was doing, but, like, whatever, how many POWs we had was, like, 50,000 surrendered, right?
Uh-huh.
And I guess they didn't agree with what Saddam Hussein was doing.
Well, whether they agreed or not, I think the vast majority of them didn't want to get into this huge war, especially consider that they had just been through an 8-year war with Iran,
right.
And they don't live anything near the way we live. A war certainly hurts them a lot more than it hurts us, and it's also being fought on their land and not on our land. So I would think the motivation would be there not to get involved in something like this a lot more than for us.
Right, that's why I also think that in the near future they're going to try and overthrow Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, you know, and they're the only people that can do that.
Right.
And I sure hope that something does happen because, yes, he does have to be held accountable because he has brought a lot of suffering. But then again, there are so many two-bit dictators around the world that have brought suffering to their people, and it's really only their people that can overthrow. You know, Ceausescu could only have been overthrown by the Romanians.
Right.
And,
Gaddafi, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. Except I don't think Gaddafi is anywhere near the threat that we painted him out to be a few years ago. That's a good example, because Gaddafi, remember, he was the biggest threat to Western civilization, all the terrorist plots he was involved in. Now, look at Iraq, you know, all the terrorism that was going to result from this war. I mean, I haven't seen anything, and I don't know if we will see anything. It seems like it was a lot of talk. And if it was a lot of talk, don't you think we should have known that it probably was a lot of talk? We were treating everything that he said as a real threat.
Right.
And I just find it hard to believe that we didn't know that it was just, you know, a lot of...
Well, then he did...
I think someone's on your phone.
Well, he did think that... he did threaten to launch a scud attack against Israel.
Right, but it was very clumsily done, don't you think? I mean, how many people died, except for the soldiers, which only happened last week... only about less than 10 people died as a result of scud attacks. Now, that's not very... I mean, I don't want to say that's not very good, but as far as from a military point of view, it's kind of stupid. You know, you shoot these things, they can land anywhere within 100 miles of where you target them. That's... I don't understand the military point.
Yeah, I don't understand that either.
But, all right, I want to thank you very much for calling.
Hey, babe, before I go, the thing that's in... Velta fish is a giant goldfish. It's called carp.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just so you want to know that.
Giant goldfish?
Yeah.
Hey, okay, thank you.
Okay, no problem.
I didn't need to hear that. Giant goldfish. Oh, boy, I'll be thinking about that for a while. 632-6901. Good evening.
Yes, I'm there. I just had you on the speakerphone.
Uh-huh.
I just have to tune in, and I'm glad that you're on the air discussing these issues.
Yeah, it seems to have been forgotten rather quickly, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I've been somewhat, how can I say, I've had mixed feelings during the course of this war, because on the one hand, it's hard to disagree with the fact that Saddam Hussein... how can I say, is not a very good guy, and hasn't been doing good things for his country. And yet, on the other hand, there's just an incredible sense of unreality about this whole thing. Because in the first place, you know, I think, you know, we, as everyone agrees, although it's often not acknowledged, we played a major role in setting this guy up because we didn't like Iran. A lot of the weapons that were being used against us were our own that we sold to him.
Uh-huh.
After the Soviets cooled off to him.
Chemical weapons, the chemicals came from this country in a good many cases.
And here in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly I'm disturbed by the incredible opportunity for a nonviolent resolution to a conflict in the Middle East that was lost. And the incredible, you know, opportunity to create some community, some true community in the Middle East, to resolve differences between Israel and the Arab countries, the Arab nation that was lost.
I think Bush would counter that by saying that a community was formed. This Arab coalition was created where none existed before against Iraq. But as you say, it was done with war as the focal point instead of a peaceful solution. And I think the thing that we have to remember is whenever there is a war, it represents a failure.
Yeah, and the lesson that came out of this is that war is a good way to resolve conflicts. War is an effective way to resolve conflicts. And the way this war has been reported, I mean, this war has been reported like a big football game.
Yeah, yeah.
Real. I mean, like, they don't talk about people being killed in large part. Well, I have seen some articles the last couple of days where there have been some discussion of it, estimates of dead. But in large part, it was reported like a game, Well, we got this many, we got this many tanks and this many this and this many that. And it was all very depersonalized. And where people, where dead were mentioned... I read statements and articles in the Times where, it was made clear by military spokespeople that this was intentional, that they had learned in Vietnam that if you talk about too many dead people and show pictures of them on TV,
mm-hmm.
it freaks the people out,
mm-hmm.
So if you talk about it like a football game, in very abstract terms, then, everybody's, sort of, yeah, let's go get them, yeah, we're doing good, we got, all this stuff. And when they interviewed Schwarzkopf, after the end of the land part of the war, and he was talking about, he used the analogy of a Hail Mary play, to describe the strategy they had used in the push through the Iraqi lines. They did an end run.
I remember that. That was incredible. Yeah, he did describe it just like a football game.
I've read. Analyses of football by anthropologists looking at football as a bizarre practice of the American culture and discussing it as a war game, but to turn it around and have an actual war where thousands of people are being killed, in some cases. We have no idea, but I suspect that, I've seen estimates that in the papers yesterday that 40,000 to 60,000. No, let me think. It was around 20,000 to 40,000Iraqis were killed, and I suspect those may be low estimates. And we have no idea. We were blowing civilians away,
mm-hmm.
at an incredible rate, and there was little talk of that. And it's disgusting.
It was, in the way that the sort of cavalier attitude that we had when we were discussing, when they were showing pictures of things blowing up. Do you remember that one particular case where they showed, I think what Schwarzkopf called them, the luckiest man in Iraq, who was driving away from this bridge just as it was blown up? And when you see this car like racing away, and then you see the bridge completely demolished, and if you just look at it a little closely, you can see that there's no way that car could have survived. It was too close.
Yeah, and how to say this? I think there was an excellent article I read. I think again it was in the Times. There's been some good coverage there. Sometimes there was an article there where it said I think it was an opinion piece a few days ago, and it pointed out that we won the war far out, but we've still got a crumbling infrastructure, an educational system in ruins. A drug and crime problem that won't stop.
And who are we going to bomb to fix that?
Yeah, who are we going to bomb? I had pointed out that, the other piece of this seems bizarre. Doesn't Schwarzkopf look a little bit like Ike? I mean, if you look at some of the pictures of Ike when he was young.
Well, I've heard rumors of him like running for political office now, and I don't know. It's going to be
another. I mean, that's the other disgusting part. Is that Bush has like, what is it, the highest approval rating of any president ever since they've been doing it?
91%.
Yeah, and I mean, oh, hell, who's against a winner? I mean, he's a winner. He won.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's like I remember from, you know, I guess I've never been through this kind of thing. The Vietnam War didn't come out this way, but you know, like, it reminds me of pep rallies in high school.
You know, it's interesting that you brought up the Vietnam thing, though, because this has, I believe it was Bush that said the Vietnam syndrome is now behind us. Do you think this was perhaps engaged in simply to wipe that out once and for all so we can have something successful to look back on as our last war and make us just all the more confident in the future for whatever it is that comes up?
That's not an impossible scenario. I mean, this may well have been a war that was fought to make the world safe for war, in a way, because, you know, I'm sure, as you noted earlier, I'm sure that the military intelligence folks were aware that Iraq wasn't as serious a threat as they were saying publicly that it was. So, you know, how many Americans died in this sucker? I mean, like,
less than 100.
Yeah, less than 100. You know,
how many Americans, let me ask you a question, how many Americans died in Vietnam? Was it something like 50,000?
I think I saw figures, it was like 50,000 to 60,000.
And we're talking, you say it was between 20 and 60. I'm hearing reports from NBC or ABC as high as 150,000 Iraqis killed, and these are just soldiers. Now, imagine the incredible advances in technology that allow us to kill three times as many people as in an entire war on our side, on the other side, just a couple of weeks. It's really staggering. I think you raise a very good point when you talk about the way certain words are used. We don't say body bags. We don't show body bags. And we use certain words like ordnance when we mean bombs and explosives and things like that. And it does have an effect because you don't think of it. They make these words so that you don't think of what they actually are. Now, there was a really good phrase. It doesn't come to my mind at the moment to describe dead people. I forget what it was. I mean, dead people, it works fine for me. That makes me realize that there are dead people. And I think if we all realized how many dead people there were lying around in the desert there, maybe we'd think twice about this.
Yeah,
about what the cost really is to this war.
And I don't know if there's some people that like, going back to the last big war, that there's some people that argue that there was no military need to drop the nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that in fact was done primarily to see how they worked in a military situation, and maybe you could make it sound less horrible by saying, you know, well, there was a choice between alternatives, and they decided that they would go with one that had the highest probability of success. But, you know, they could have dropped one of the suckers on some island somewhere, you know, and scared the shit out of them.
Well, it seems like there's always a way out. There's always some way out of a Holocaust.
Yeah. Okay. But the reason I brought that up was, yeah, in analogy to that. You know, and if you've read some of the military analyses where they've pointed out that this war was fought with what they called their new air ground war strategy, and I wouldn't put it entirely past the American military to have decided that this was a good opportunity for a full scale test of their new strategy. New equipment and you know, combination of new technology and new ideas of coordinated ground air action in a situation that where they had a reasonably good chance of winning with minimal casualties.
I think it was stated right up front that they were very pleased to see how their new weapons were working. The Patriot missile, for instance, was something that they never knew the defensive capabilities of that. And that was shown, so they were quite happy to see these things be actually tested, as you say. In Panama, the stealth bomber was used. They wanted to see how that would work out. So yeah, a lot of this is for testing purposes to see how exactly our weaponry will work in battle, and that could explain. It's a possibility that could explain why this battle was so one-sided and why we all thought it was going to be so much more rigorous, you know?
Yeah, so it's a combination of, you know, a need to test the equipment and the strategy and under actual battlefield conditions and a need to boost flagging American self-image and flagging American sort of self-confidence.
I don't know if we needed a boost, you know? I think... I don't know. I don't think we needed this kind of a boost.
Well, I mean, obviously, I would agree with you that this wasn't what we needed, but...
Well, I know this is what we needed, but I'm saying the morale of America, you know, apart from the drudgeries of day-to-day life and, you know, an economy that wasn't really working out at the moment, I still think we could have done just fine without getting into a military thing where we had to win and...
I agree with you.
...have this glorious victory. Anyway, sir, I want to get a couple more calls. Thanks very much for calling.
Yeah, thanks for the time. Take care.
Okay. 632-6901. You know, I like the calls we've been getting. It's I was kind of expecting to get you know, all kinds of hostility and people saying, oh, you know, you're not with us, you're not one of us, you're against what we stand for, and our troops fought and risked their lives, and they're coming home, and they deserve ticker tape parades and all that, and. You know, I've said from the very beginning, and I think most of the peace movement has said from the very beginning, that it's got nothing to do with the troops. There's very, very few people that don't support who they are and don't want them back. This is so much bigger than that. This is about what is right, what is wrong, what is justified, what the price for a particular cause is. And it's about hypocrisy, you know, it's about... supporting somebody and then suddenly not supporting them, and doing everything you can to get them out of power, and then starting it all over again. You know, we gotta watch this. I wish that the media people would pay more attention to groups like Amnesty International. The next time Bush has a press conference, quote them. You know, say, well, how come we're giving so much money and a military aid to a person that has this many political prisoners, a leader whose country is known to practice torture, whose citizens who question him disappear and are never seen again, where women and children are murdered. Why? You know, we don't see questions like that, and, well, okay, why don't we see questions like that? Because if a reporter... ask that kind of a question, it would be pretty much career suicide on his part. The American public would not understand. He would be anti-American. And nothing, I believe, is more anti-American than that kind of suspicion and quick hostility, reminiscent of the McCarthy era. Now, do you think the McCarthy era was pro-American? I don't think that was pro-American. I think that was... a far bigger threat to us than the Red Scare ever was. 632-6901, we got time for a couple more calls. Good evening.
Yes, I'd like to address a few points of view.
Go ahead.
All right, first of all, I'd like to talk about George Bush and how we went through the Reagan era, and it was kind of a laissez-faire attitude, do nothing. And right around the time we needed a president, a hero president of war, we just happened to fall into two wars.
Uh-huh.
And,
two wars in the first term.
And both were a success, so it's kind of... you don't think he's going to let the Democrats forget about it.
Well, you forgot Grenada, though. That was Reagan's war. Grenada was Reagan's war, and that was quite successful,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, but was it very pop... Was it very,
Well, yeah, you know, that was the first time, the first inkling that the press was not so favorably viewed by the American public, because the press wanted to cover the war. The administration didn't want them to cover it. God knows why. I don't know what they were afraid of in that particular war. But the press's insistence lost them quite a few points with the American public. And that was, I think that's what started to change the press a little bit and make them say, oh, well, we better be careful what we do and what we say because the American people aren't necessarily on our side.
Yes, but it seems like the things that the press should be covering, like the forgotten people. I mean, how many people did we lose? And then we hear on CNN from Powell that we lost just 80 people. It's kind of amazing when those 80 people, they're forgotten egots of life. They're unheard of, and they touch so many other people's lives.
Very true. And those 80 people certainly are important and should not be forgotten and cast away, and we should not say, oh, only 80 people died. That's great. 80 people died. That's horrible.
I mean, if you heard that, it would be so much more, seems much worse if it was 80 school children. But why is that different?
And why would 80 Iraqi school children be different than 80 American school children?
Exactly.
I see what you're saying. It's, we seem to have a numbness towards tragedy in the rest of the world. The rest of the world, they have all the tragedies. You know, there's a train crash in Mexico and 100 people die. There's a train crash in this country and 3 people die. You know, we are just spared. And we're spared because, well, we're technologically capable of preventing things from getting out of hand. But we also don't help. We don't help the other parts of the world get a fair shake. You know, we precipitate things, I think, in other areas of the world.
Even, I mean, I don't like to admit it, but I'm numb too. I mean, we kind of grow up in a society where saying this isn't so bad.
Mm-hmm.
And,
well, it's very good of you to admit it, because I don't think there's very many of us that can say that they don't feel like that. I mean, you read something in the newspaper, you read about Amtrak having a crash, you're more concerned than a train in India having a crash. Of course, you are. It's just that's the way things occur. And it's hard to explain why that is, and it is disturbing. But as long as you realize it's disturbing, you have a chance of doing something about it.
I mean, a life is a life, no matter where it's from. And people just have to wake up and realize, just because he speaks a different language and we may be at war with him, he's no less of a man than you or I.
That is true. And I, for one, would sure like to understand what what was going on, you know, what was going on in Saddam's head, and a lot more. You know, I'd like to know more about the particular culture.
I know, it seems as if they make that all his ideas were hodgepodge.
I think there's a lot more going on than what we have been led to believe. He was not insane. He certainly is not insane. He knew something of what he was doing, but obviously his policies didn't quite work out. When you come up against the United States, things have a tendency of going wrong for you. I mean, witness Nicaragua. That country never had a chance once the United States turned full force against it. So it's, you know, people act irrationally sometimes when they're cornered with outrageous odds. And I think that's probably what happened to Saddam. He just kind of lost his cool and continued to make challenges and threats that he couldn't possibly keep, and Bush made it completely impossible for him to back down or slink away even.
It was kind of set up that way because, as the way I heard it, was that we knew he was going in there, and we gave him the attitude that we were going to do nothing. And he went along with that, and we kind of opened the door to a closet and locked him in. He had no way of getting out of it.
Uh-huh. I don't want to give the impression that either one of us are sympathetic to him. Of course, a lot of people would say we were for saying this, but it's important that you try to understand what's going on in the head of your opponent, if in fact he is your opponent. And I think that's...
I mean, it could be said about most tyrants. I mean, they're not insane men. They're sane men with insane dreams.
Yeah, very true. Listen, sir, we got one more call I want to get to. Thanks very much for calling, and have a good night. Sorry, I didn't get the last part of what he was saying, but we're going to go to one more call. Keep this in mind, folks. You know, I'd say we outranked the Iraqis by, this is not an exaggeration, by about 1,000 to 1. And what I mean by that is, take a look at the casualties. They seem to have had 1,000 times more casualties than we have had. 1,000 times, that's not an exaggeration. Now, think about it. Is it fair if, say, you're going to school and that big jerk that's always bothering you bothers you again? It might feel good. It might feel just and righteous. But is it the right thing to do to get 1,000 people together and beat the living crap out of that person the next time you see him? Is that right? You know, where do we draw the line? 1,000 times more? 100 times more? An even match? What? Or is bloody conflict the way to solve any of this at any time? You know, people bring up World War II, and I always dislike that analogy because World War II, I think, is a worst-case scenario, or a very near worst-case scenario. War seems to feed upon itself. World War II was born out of World War I. World War I was completely avoidable, and that's why I worry when I see an avoidable war actually play through. If we embarrass Saddam Hussein, if we destroy his country, God knows what kind of regime could rise out of that and prey on nationalistic instincts. Let's take one more call. Good evening.
Hi, I was just listening to everyone's comments and everything. I really do think we should have some sort of parade for when the troops come home, or at least one day set aside where no one goes to work and the stores are all closed and there's a parade in every major city, just like to show at least that we care.
Well, I'm all for showing that we care. It's just that, you know, the jubilation, it rubs me the wrong way. Yes, I want to feel happy that they're home, but to feel happy for what happened over there, I think what happened over there is sad, on all sides.
Because they always come out saying, and they always say, well, we got through this war, and like you said, only 80 or so people died. Well, as far as I'm concerned, if one died, that's still too many. What about that family?
Uh-huh.
So it's still too many, but I think for the girls and guys that are coming over from serving back there, I think it's nice just to do something for them. And something that David Dinkins had said, he had said that he didn't want the city funding it,
uh-huh.
a ticket tape parade, and you wanted more corporate businesses
right.
to fund it because he said the city had no money. I can't figure out how he wouldn't want to have a parade for something for his own country, but he had like a parade for Nelson Mandela, and that cost $3 million. But
well, I know that was before all this budget stuff went down, so that might have something to do with it. But first of all, I don't know why it cost so much money to have a parade in the first place.
Right.
I'm all for celebrations, but when I see a lot of money being spent and I see a lot of suffering going on, it just, like I said, it rubs me the wrong way. It just seems like something should be done to relieve the suffering, and there's no joy does not cost money. You know, you can have a happy occasion
right.
without spending money on it and without doing all the ticker tape and festive stuff. I don't know. You know, maybe
we should just have a day and not have the parade, just have like a solemn day.
I think having a day is a good idea. I think having a day where people don't go to work is a very good idea. I just kind of reflect upon all this. It's just the call to arms and the, we beat them and we're greater than them. I think
now we know that, and maybe we don't even have to.
The conflict is over. We need to now rebuild things both here and there.
Right.
And I think there's nothing greater than the feeling that your enemy is no longer your enemy and that you work to improve things with that enemy.
Right. You were saying about the reporters. I think the media had a large part to play in this war, and we always looked upon it and we said, well, how can the Iraqis, the civilians, say Saddam Hussein is so great? Well, it's because they only get one news source, and that's the government source. And in a way, I sort of think we sort of had that same sort of source, except it was an American source. There was a report coming out right before the war had started, before President Bush had gone to... after President Bush had gone to Saudi Arabia for Thanksgiving dinner, that an American was in Saudi Arabia and he had brought a love boat tape and a videotape.
Uh-huh.
And the Saudis confiscated the videotape, and they watched it, and because they had girls in the bikinis in the background, they thought it was offensive, and they put the man in prison. And then they tortured him. And the brother of the man who was sent over there, along with the sister, went to Washington and tried to lobby and even got in touch with the president and tried to have the president speak about this. And then it surfaced later, but very quietly, like on a page 7 of the New York Times, right after he had come, that, well, he really didn't want to say anything about it. Why start getting hostilities with people if you're using their land to fight a war to help them? He didn't want to cause any troubles, let the American go. So we still don't even know if he's been let out yet.
That is something that deserves to be followed up on. Listen, sir, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for calling, and we can resume this discussion next week, I suppose. We're slowly getting back to normal here at the radio station. No more Gulf War Citizen Action updates, as there is no more Gulf War. Next week we'll probably go back to our regular programming. Well, who knows, the tripods might even be back next week, and we'll have Radio Moscow and all kinds of fun things like that, and maybe we won't run over, as we always have been doing the last few weeks. To everybody else, though, I encourage you to keep thinking freely, keep asking questions. Don't be intimidated by what people say you have to believe, because we believe what is in our hearts, and we come to that decision by ourselves and with no one's help. I want to go out with a piece of music. It's kind of embarrassing, actually, by the Electric Light Orchestra. Brett's laughing at me. Well, it's a song about war, okay? It's a song about a soldier that comes back from war. All right, it's called Boy Blue. There's a line in there that says, wait, let's see if I actually have the lyrics. No, I don't have the lyrics, so I'll have to see if I can remember this. At the end, he says, "No man shall cause me to take up arms again." And that's like, the most important thing that comes out of being in a war is that determination that no way am I ever going to go through this again, and no way am I ever going to try to get somebody else to go through this again. I think you see that in a lot of Vietnam vets. I suggest that people listen because they know what they're talking about. All right. We'll see you next week, eh? And stay tuned for Good Bread and all kinds of fun things, eh? All right. Electric Light Orchestra. Good night.
Comme test NFT.